Good morning, everyone. I would like to invite Ellen Lautz up to introduce our presenters today. Ellen is not only a Thursday Morning Roundtable member, she is also on the Syracuse Stage Guild, so she'll start us off.
Good morning. I'm very pleased, as a Guild member and a Syracuse resident, I'm very pleased to introduce Robert Hupp, who's in his first season as the Artistic Director of Syracuse Stage. Prior to coming to Central New York, he spent 17 seasons as the Producing Artistic Director of the Arkansas Repertory Theater in Little Rock, where he directed 30 productions, ranging from Hamlet to Les Mis to Grapes of Wrath. While in Arkansas, Robert was named the Nonprofit Executive of the Year by the Arkansas Business Publishing Group and the Individual Artist of the Year by the Arkansas Arts Council. Earlier in his career, Robert had spent 9 seasons as the Artistic Director of the Obie Award-winning Jean Cocteau Repertory in New York City. At the Cocteau, Robert's directing credits included premieres of the new version of Brecht's Mother Courage and Her Children, Shaman Heaney's The Cure of Troy, Eduardo de Filippo's Napoli Millionaire, and before joining the faculty at Syracuse, he held positions at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, University of Arkansas at Little Rock, and served on panels, funding panels, for the National Endowment of the Arts and the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs. When he first came to Syracuse, one of his early decisions was to promote Kyle Bass. Kyle had been the resident dramaturg, and now he's the Associate Artistic Director of Syracuse Stage. Kyle is a playwright, a screenwriter, a prose writer, and a poet. He's a proud member of the Dramatists Guild of America. He's a 2-time New York Foundation for the Arts Fellow and the author of plays Tender Rain, Bleecker Street, and Possessing Harriet. In case anybody doesn't know, that's Harriet Tubman. No? Oh, it's not? Oh, wait, sorry. Apologies. Good. Well, you know, I didn't do enough homework. Kyle is the co-writer of the original screenplay Day of Days, the independent film starring Hollywood actor Tom Skerritt. He's taught at Goddard College, Syracuse, Colgate, Hobart, and William Smith. I'm very pleased to introduce Robert Hupp and Kyle Barrett.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us on this snowy morning. It's great to see you all. Let's ask our actors to come up and have a seat. As you know, just last weekend, we opened Ayat Akbar's play, Disgraced, which runs this weekend and next weekend at Syracuse Stage. Our marketing department bills the play as 90 minutes that will rock your world. And I think we're finding that as we've opened. One of the things that we've done with this play, because it is only 90 minutes, and because it is a play, as you'll see, as Kyle will set the scene, and the actors, we're going to do a little scene from the play, you'll see that the issues that arise in the play are issues that appear to be ripped from the headlines and have great impact on us here in Syracuse and on our nation. And so one of the things that we decided to do in response to this the sort of energy surrounding the themes of this play is we've added talkbacks after every performance. And over a third of the audience has remained almost every night to join the actors and community leaders and staff from Syracuse Stage to talk about the themes of this play. So if you haven't had a chance yet to come down and see Disgraced, I urge you to come down and see this play and join us in this conversation. We're faced with so many issues that confront us right now that we're trying to sort out. And sometimes, you know, I find myself talking back to the television. Well, and it's probably better that there's nobody in the room with me to hear that. But come to the theater where we have the communal experience, where we can share ideas together. And that's what I think brings us to the power of Disgraced. This play was written in 2012. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 2013. Last year, it was the most produced play in America. You know, like all great theater, it originated at a nonprofit theater in Chicago. It moved to Off-Broadway, then it moved to London, then it moved back to Broadway, garnering many awards for its author and great acclaim for its cast. And we're glad to have our cast here today that are telling this story seemingly 8 nights a week or 8 times a week on our stage. Can I ask you guys to introduce yourself and let us know where you're from and what role you're playing? And Jillian, let's start with you.
Hi, I'm Jillian Glasgow, playing Jory, originally from Little Rock, Arkansas, living in New York City.
Hi, I'm James Ludwig. I play Isaac. I grew up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, so this is very familiar to me. And I live in New York City.
Hi, Andrew Ramcharan Gilarte. I play Amir, originally from the Caribbean, living in New York.
Hi, I'm Victoria Mack, playing Emily, originally from New Jersey, living in New York.
And let me turn it over to Kyle Bass to set our scene for us.
Thank you, Bob. Good morning, all. So imagine, if you will, an East Side Manhattan apartment. And we have Amir Kapoor, who is married to Emily. Amir is a lawyer. Emily is a painter, and she uses Islamic figuration in her work. We have Isaac, who is a curator at the Whitney Museum, interested in perhaps showing some of Emily's work. And we have Jory, who is also a lawyer and a colleague of Amir's at the law firm. Up to this point, Amir has been asked by his wife to intercede to counsel an imam who has been arrested. Amir is Pakistani-American. He is keeping his Muslim background on the down low, if you will. But he has, before this scene, been called into the offices at his firm, and his bosses want to know more about him because he's been associated with this imam. It's shown up in the New York Times, and it's now made his life very, very difficult as his secret is about to come out. This is a dinner party that the four of them are at, and we pick that up just beyond the opening of that scene.
Kapoor! Where in India is that name from?
Why are you asking?
Did I say something wrong?
No. Stephen came into my office today and asked me the same thing.
He did?
You know, it's a pretty common Punjabi name.
I'm headed to Delhi day after tomorrow. That's in Punjab, isn't it?
Not really, but same country, so why not?
What are you doing in Delhi, Isaac?
Sothi Sikander has deigned to offer me a studio visit.
Oh, how exciting. I love his work. Mm. You going too?
Ezra has school.
Oh. Jory is being polite. It is not because Ezra has school. I have a little bit of an issue when it comes to flying.
That's one way of putting it.
I hate flying. It's a primal thing. The thought of not being on the ground opens up this door to, like, every fear I have. And the hysteria around security only makes it worse.
It's a nightmare at the airports.
Oh, and now there's a whole new attraction. You get to decide between being ogled over or felt up.
Felt up, definitely.
Why is that not a surprise?
It actually calms me down. What's that like for you?
What?
Security at airports. I mean, you hear stories.
Wouldn't know. I cut right to the chase.
He volunteers himself. Goes right up to the agents and offers himself up.
What? To be searched?
I know they're looking at me, and it's not because I look like Giselle. I figure why not make it easier for everyone involved?
I've never heard of anyone doing that before.
On top of people being more and more afraid of folks who look like me, we end up being resented, too.
Those agents are working hard not to discriminate. Then here's this guy who comes up to them and calls them out.
Pure, unmitigated passive aggression. That's what my wife thinks.
Maybe she's got a point.
I think it's kind of admirable, Amir. If everyone was so forthcoming, this world would be a very different place.
It's racial profiling.
Honey, I know what it is.
I can't imagine you'd like that if it was you.
It's not her. That's the point.
It's probably not some Kansas grandmother in a wheelchair.
The next terrorist attack is probably going to come from some guy who more or less looks like me.
I totally disagree. The next attack is coming from some white guy with a gun he shouldn't
and
have.
And pointing it at a guy who looks like me.
Not necessarily.
If every person of Middle Eastern descent started doing what you are doing, I mean, if we all got used to that kind of compliance, we might all start getting a little too comfortable with our suspicions.
So you do have suspicions?
Not me.
Look, I don't blame you.
Wait, what?
Could you give me a glass of port? Excuse me. It's Abe.
Abe?
Your nephew? Huh.
What's he calling you about?
Did he call you and you not call him back?
Yeah?
So he's calling me. You gotta work on that, honey. You guys hungry?
Yeah.
Getting there.
I'm starting us with a fennel salad. Oh. Do you eat anchovies?
Love them. And I love fennel. Mm.
A fennel anchovy salad is a classic.
Mm. See, honey? An exemplary instance of spousal support. Mm. He never compliments my cooking.
I do most of the cooking.
Because you never show me any love when I do.
Cooking is not your strongest suit.
I can't believe you just said that.
You don't have to eat what she cooks.
Ezra loves my cooking.
Your Kraft macaroni and cheese.
And my Swiss Miss hot chocolate.
Look, you make a good omelet.
I haven't made an omelet in ages.
Might be the best thing about them.
Oh, I am not listening to any more of this.
Would you like some help?
Thank you, Joy. I would love some.
Just keep her away from the ingredients. I'm sorry if I brought up something sensitive. Between you and Emily, I mean.
You didn't.
Oh.
It's not a secret. Em and I don't see eye to eye on Islam. I think it's a backward way of thinking and being.
You don't think that's maybe a little broad? I mean, it does happen to be one of the world's great spiritual traditions.
Let me guess. You're reading Rumi.
Amir. Actually, yes, I've been reading Rumi, and he's great, but that's not what I'm talking about. Do you know Hanif Sayeed?
I don't.
He is a sculptor. He's Muslim. He's devout. Yeah. His work is an amazing testimony to the power of faith. He carves these monolithic, pillar-like forms.
Have you read the Quran, Isaac?
I haven't, but
when it comes to Islam, monolithic, pillar-like forms don't matter. And paintings don't matter. Only the Quran matters.
Paintings don't matter?
I didn't mean it like that.
How did you mean it?
Honey, you aware of what the Prophet said about them?
I am, Amir.
What'd he say?
He used to say that angels don't enter a house where there are pictures and or dogs.
What's wrong with dogs?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Every religion has idiosyncrasies. My ancestors didn't like lobster. Who doesn't like lobster? What's your point?
My point is that what a few artists are doing, however wonderful, does not reflect the Muslim psyche.
Muslim psyche?
Hmm. Islam comes from the desert, from a group of tough-minded, tough-living people who saw life as something hard and relentless, something to be suffered.
Not the only people to have suffered in a desert for centuries, Amir. I don't know what that says about the Jewish psyche, if that's the word we're going to use.
Desert pain. I can work with that. Jews reacted to the situation differently. They turned it over and over and over. I mean, look at the Talmud. They're looking at things from 100 different angles, trying to negotiate with it, make it easier, more livable.
Find new ways to complain about it.
Whatever they do, it's not what Muslims do. Muslims don't complain. They submit. That's what Islam means, by the way. Submission.
I know what it means. Look, the problem isn't Islam. It's Islamo-fascism.
Guys, salad?
Martin Amis, right?
Hitchens, too. They're not wrong about that.
I'm starving.
You haven't read the Quran, but you've read a couple of sanctimonious British bullies, and you think you know something about Islam?
Amir!
What? That's not fair game? If he's going to offer it as a counter, it's fair game.
He has a point. I need to read the Quran.
Did you want fresh pepper?
I had to read some of it in college. What I remember is the anger.
Thank you. It's like one very long hate mail letter to humanity.
That's not true, Jory.
It is, kind of. Grant me that, at least.
I'll grant you that the Quran sees humanity as stubborn and self-interested, and it takes us to task for that. And I can't say it's wrong to do so.
All I was saying with Islamofascism is that there's a difference between the religion and the political use of it.
Isaac, in Islam, there's no difference. There's no distinction between church and state.
Well, don't you mean mosque and state?
I do, thank you. I'm assuming we're all opposed to people who treat the Bible like the Constitution.
Bon appetit.
Bon appetit.
This is so good.
Did I tell you or did I tell you?
It's so easy. You just slice everything up.
Fennel, peppers, celery.
Carrots, radishes.
Ooh, what are these?
Baby artichokes.
You know, what gets me just as much as people who treat the Bible like the Constitution are the people who treat the Constitution like the Bible. Mm. I mean, trying to figure out what a text written more than 200 years ago really meant. Like it's gonna solve our problems of today.
Like all that but the right to bear arms? It was 1791, people.
That's my point. That's exactly what I'm saying, honey.
This is so good, Em. Really.
I picked up the recipe on a Fulbright in Sevilla.
I love Spain. I ran with the bulls in Pamplona.
You did not run with the bulls.
I watched people run with the bulls. It was thrilling.
We went to Barcelona for our honeymoon. The chorizo, The paella, the wine. Spanish wines are so underrated.
See, this is the problem I'm having. You're saying that Muslims are so different. You're not that different. You have the same idea of the good life as I do. I wouldn't have even known you were a Muslim if it hadn't been for that article in the Times.
I am not Muslim. I'm an apostate, which means I've renounced my faith.
I know what the word apostate means.
You also know that according to the Quran, it makes me punishable by death.
That's not true, Amir.
Yes, it is.
Have you even read that part? Have you? It condemns renouncing the faith, but it doesn't specify punishment. The tradition has interpreted it as punishable by death.
Huh. Impressive.
Well, he's repeated it enough. I checked. I have a vested interest after all.
Fine. So let's talk about something that is in the text. Wife beating.
Wife beating.
Great. Could you pass the bread?
Amir, really?
So the angel Gabriel comes to Muhammad.
Angel Gabriel.
Yeah. That's how Muslims believe the Quran came to humanity. The angel Gabriel supposedly dictated it to Muhammad word for word.
Like Joseph Smith. Mormonism. An angel named Marami came down in upstate New York and talked just to Joseph Smith.
Maroni, honey, not Marami.
You sure?
It was on South Park.
So, like I was saying, the angel Gabriel shows up and teaches Muhammad this verse. You know the one, honey. I'm paraphrasing. Men are in charge of women.
Amir.
If they don't obey, talk to them. If that doesn't work, don't sleep with them. And if that doesn't work,
I'm not doing this.
Beat them.
I don't remember that being in the Quran.
Oh, it's there already.
The usual translation is debatable.
Only to people who are trying to make Islam look all warm and fuzzy.
The root verb can mean beat, but it can also mean leave. So it could be saying, if your wife doesn't listen, leave her, not beat her.
Sounds like a pretty big difference.
It hasn't been interpreted that way for hundreds of years.
No, see? Sometimes you just have to say no. I don't blame the French.
The French?
For their problem with Islam.
You're okay with them banning the veil?
You do have to draw the line somewhere.
Okay, Mrs. Kissinger.
Endearing.
I am married to a woman who has a Kissinger quote above her desk in the den.
If faced with choosing justice or order, I'll always choose order.
Why do you have that above your desk?
To remind myself. Not to get lost in the feeling that I need to get justice. You pull yourself out of the ghetto. You realize real soon, order is where it's at.
Me, justice, always.
You know what they say. If you're young and not a liberal, you've got no heart. But if you're old and not a conservative,
you've got no brain.
Thanks, guys.
I'm going to ask you to keep your seats right there.
I was leaving. Sorry. I'll come back. I was going to get my coffee.
Thank you, guys. That was terrific. So, you know, here we have this play and we have, you know, presumably, you know, a WASP white woman. We have a, described perhaps a self-loathing Muslim man. We have a Jewish man, an African-American woman. So I'm going to ask the cast if you would talk about just briefly what it's like to be doing this play at this time in this country.
Well, we started previews on Wednesday, last Wednesday. The day that the ban was announced, I believe. So, and was it, well...
The ban was announced for it.
Whatever happened Wednesday.
It's one of those things.
It's a moment-to-moment thing. You turn on the TV, you look at Twitter, and something else blew up. Whatever happened Wednesday was like, wow, this is really amazing that we're doing this play right now. And then as we got further into the weekend, as the ban became more of a thing and the protests began, it was... To be doing this play right now in this world is so important. We feel very lucky and blessed. They're not the right words, because I would rather not have to be doing this play at this time in this world. But if this is what we have to do to, quote unquote, fight the good fight, then I'm all for it.
Anyone else?
I feel like a lot of the play has to do with self-identity and marginalization and, you know, what it takes to assimilate, to become a part of society, to gain respect and status and be validated and feel that, you know, you can be appreciated for all of your worth and with what's going on globally and with our country and with this administration, it just sort of feels like the character of Amir and people who fight so hard to get the respect and be assimilated, it just realizes all of those worst fears. And you know, you understand why a character like Amir exists, and you understand why the sort of marginalization that we allow in this country at its worst is one of the greatest tragedies that we continue to perpetuate here. And so I feel like what's going on with the administration, it's just highlighting, and it shows the sort of foundation for why characters like Amir are so tragic.
Tori, you have a response about working on this
part? I fully second what both of them said. That's my response. No, I think that's spot on. I think that this play, I mean, when we talk about doing this play right now, it's interesting because the play is not just like a clear-cut anti-Trump or whatever kind of agenda. It doesn't have that kind of agenda. And in fact, I don't really know that it has a political agenda. It's really just a story of this one man and his journey. And one of the questions we keep getting asked in talkbacks is questions that have to do with how do we read this play as sort of standing for Muslim Americans or something. And I think what's interesting about the play is that it doesn't. Mm-hmm. It's not a play about Islam. Our director at one point in rehearsal said, this is not a Muslim play, this is an American play. This is a play about this character and his journey and his struggle and his journey towards some kind of self-knowledge, I think, you know? Yeah. And so it's a play about identity and self-knowledge. It's not a play so much about religion, even though religion is what these characters are grappling with so much. So I think it's, you know, obviously it is a fascinating time to be doing a play about a Muslim American man. But I think what's so strong about the play, actually, is that it's not about that. Is that what's missing in the theater world right now is that there are not more voices about these kinds of stories. And so this feels like a play about Muslim Americans. Mm. And I think that what's extraordinary is it's not. It's about one character who happens to be that. And I'm hoping that we get to a time where people aren't wondering how this place stands for all Muslims, you know? Because it's this guy's story. And if he were a Christian American or something like that, it wouldn't be seen as the story of Christians in America, you know? Mm-hmm.
To build on that, one of the things that we're noticing that we've heard in talkbacks that we think is really interesting, there are actually two Muslim Americans in this play. Our castmate Nick, who actually got to sleep in today, is also Muslim. And one of the things we heard in talkbacks was, isn't it wonderful that, or isn't it interesting that we get to see these two Muslim American men who are approaching the religion in such a different way. Isn't that so cool? Whereas if you were to put two Christians in a room and look at how they approach Christianity differently, and it's, I'm sure, very widely different, none of us would bat an eyelash, because that's just what we're used to. So the play, I think, is sort of reinforcing the idea that you know, people approach this particular religion in many, many different ways, just as we approach all the other religions that make up the kaleidoscope in this country.
Andrew, can I ask you, you've played this role before at the Alliance. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the differences, if any, that you are experiencing between playing the role in another city, another region of the country, and also at a different time?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was thinking about that. The play was, you know, it was a year ago, and I think the big difference now, I think it's harder for me right now. You know, you get on stage and you're saying things, and you're like, oh my God, this is happening. You know, there is the fear mongering, you know, and the labeling that's actually happening right now. But this play is—it's always been powerful to do, because it asks questions and it's what's been happening in society for a long time. The marginalization, like Jillian said, the problems of being classified as an other, and not fitting in, not being given the same opportunity for success unless you assimilate, unless you change your appearance or whatever. So it's always been very hot. And doing it in Atlanta, it was the same response as here. You sold out houses and 300 plus people staying for talkbacks afterwards to talk about it. And after the talkbacks, standing in the lobby to talk about it, you know, because it's very hot. It's always been hot. And now even more so because everything, you know, before it was easy to say, oh, this doesn't exist in this country. There's denial about racism. We're in a post-racist world, post-race or whatever, and supposedly. But now all of a sudden everything's coming to the surface, and there's a lot of open hatred, you know, and I think that's the difference doing it now because it's become more overt, more obvious, the discriminations, you know, oh, we gotta fear these types of people from this type of place who believe in such and such, you know. So it's nice to be doing it now. I mean, the audiences here are great too. It's so responsive, so want to talk about it, and it's a difficult play, it really is, you know, and it doesn't present any answers really.
No resolution.
No, yeah. There's no answer. So it's very much about what you take from it, and sometimes it's a reflection of how you think in the way you receive the play, you know.
Thank you. I'm going to open it up to the audience for questions for cast members. Is there a question? Yes, sir.
That was fantastic. I can't wait to see the performance. I'll hold it. I can't hold it. There's also, you know, post the 2016 presidential election discussion that the liberals live on the coasts and the heart of America is in the Midwest and in the Deep South. And obviously we saw that in the electoral result. Have you done it in the Midwest? I'm not talking Chicago. I mean, have you done it in rural areas? I'm not sure that's the market, but I mean, I'd be anxious as, you know.
We haven't done it personally.
Not us.
But it's played everywhere. States. This show's been, yeah.
A friend of mine actually is playing Isaac at Milwaukee Rep right now. I don't know how many theaters in the country are doing Disgrace this year, but
Last year, it
was the most produced play in the country.
Yeah. Do we know what number that might be? Is it, you know, 10 theaters, 20, 30? Do we know?
A lot.
But all through the U.S.
Yeah.
And I do know, just to jump on that, a friend of mine just played Emily. Right. I love how we're friends with people who play our own characters. So that's really funny.
I'm not. I unfriend all of them.
A friend of mine just played Emily at the Guthrie in Minneapolis.
Minneapolis.
Thank you. And I know there's like a huge Somali population there, and everybody went and saw the show. So that's the only experience I've heard about in that part of the country. And it was incredibly popular there, and they had talkbacks after every show. And what I know from that experience is she said they hated Emily so much. Yeah. And so that's what I had heard about doing the show. When I got the job, I was terrified. Everyone was just going to hate me.
I like to be hated.
Good morning. First, I'd like to say how fortunate are we to have a company like Syracuse Stage with the direction of Bob and Kyle and their staff who can bring and bring to us actors of the quality and caliber like these four people. So I hope you all support Syracuse Stage like we should. I have two questions, actually. One is I'd like to ask the actors what your experience has been like with, particularly working with Syracuse Stage. You all have experience with many other organizations, and so to let all of us know kind of behind the scenes and what your experience coming here from New York City is with working in this market and with this particular company. And then I'd like to ask a question of Kyle Bass, somewhat self-serving, if you can explain to us or tell us a little bit about Harriet Powell, the other Harriet, and who she is and what is the project that you're working on with that.
I'll let you guys answer the question first about...
It's my first time in Syracuse, at the Syracuse stage, and I'm loving it. You know,
it's great housing.
Great housing. And it's so comfortable. And the company that we're working with, everyone has been so beautiful, kind. Mayor Drouse, who's the director, and it's what, her third time here, right?
Yes.
And the cast that she put together, we didn't know each other before. But we get along famously. Thank God for that, because to do a play like this with people you don't like is trouble. There's been a lot of support, and with these guys, it's been amazing. I'm having a blast.
I know.
It's gone by so fast.
It's been really more than accommodating.
I felt super
at home. Yeah. Anything we need. Yeah. Like, people have been asking for blenders and humidifiers, and they get them.
Yeah, people.
No, but it's been very accommodating, and there seems to be a great effort for social awareness and community responsibility, so that's great.
You guys have a lot to be proud of in yourselves, too. I think the audiences here are we've so enjoyed, I feel like more than any theater I've worked in several years, because of the fact that we're doing so many talkbacks, I mean, every single, and we're getting to meet a lot of the audiences, and wow, what a smart and well-read and informed and asking great questions, and not only asking questions, but saying, well, what can I do?
What can I do?
You know, and that's huge, because there's people getting ready to walk out of the theater and actually do, even if, whether it's a little thing or a big thing, to like go and make a change, to do something to try and change things for the better, which is why this kind of theater exists, to get people out of their seats and moving. So I've always wanted to work here. I'm so glad I've been here, and I think it's a great, you guys have a great institution here.
Mm. Great, thank you. I'll be very brief about the project I'm working on. I'm writing a play called Possessing Harriet, which was commissioned by OHA, the Onondaga Historical Association, and it tells the story of an enslaved woman who's brought to Syracuse by her owners in 1839, and while she's here, she makes the difficult decision to escape slavery and is put onto the Underground Railroad here in central New York. As part of that story, she meets with a young Elizabeth Cady Stanton, not yet Stanton, and they spent some time together. And I'm in the process of dramatizing that meeting. It's gone through some development. It will go through more, and I'm very, very happy about the future of the play. So, thank you.
He keeps reminding he's not baking a cake.
Yes, Sarah, please. Okay, thank you.
Hi, great job. I'm looking forward to seeing the play. I don't know if this is too personal or not, but does that quote really exist by Henry Kissinger?
Yes. You know? But there's like a couple of versions of that quote.
Yeah.
Like, so, that's, I think, the most condensed version of the quote. But yes, it is a real quote.
So unless this is too personal, if you don't mind, you're acting up here. But how do you feel about that quote personally?
Oh, no, I don't believe in that.
Okay, thank you. And I'm not sure who said it about the Christian thing, but depending on what type of Christian you're talking to, because there's what I call the Pope Francis Christian, and then there's the other Christians, and then there's a segment of them that, so I just wanted to bring that out, that there's a lot of different Christians. Thank you.
Actually, this is a very diverse community in so many ways. And politically, we keep electing Republicans and then Democrats and then Republicans and then Democrats. What are you feeling in the feedback of the audience? How diverse is that audience? Are you getting a diverse sense of response to your play?
Are you asking if what people are saying is diverse or if the audience?
Are they consistently similar, or are we getting that same sense that people are responding to it differently?
You know, I'm getting a general sense that people want us to be able to come together in a better way. I think people stay for the talk back looking for a resolution and wanting to be on the right side of things, whatever that whatever that means. And I think that people don't want the sort of tragic downfall of an Amir or anyone to continue to happen. It sort of feels like that people are looking for the resolution that we're not giving them, and they want to be able to talk through it and whatever can happen in like the 20 minutes after the show. You know, I think everyone is feeling that they, I don't know, I'm having a hard time. You go. I can't talk.
I'll give you one story from one talkback that I think I'll probably talk about for a long time, which was the, we basically have, I will call our standard audience, you know, over 50 and white. And then we have a lot of other folks who are coming to see this play as well. And one particular performance, the imam of the mosque here in Syracuse came. The one that's right next to the university. And he really enjoyed the show. And he spoke for a minute and wanted to make sure that, you know, we're a part of this community and we want you guys involved. And then the very next question was a gentleman who looked quite a bit like you, sir, and said, "What can I do?" And stood up and spoke directly to the imam and said, "What can I do to help you? What can we do? What can this audience do to help you?" And I shed a tear. I mean, because that's exactly what a piece of theater like this is meant for. You know, I hope that gentleman takes a bunch of people over to the mosque and shows up for evening prayer one day and sees what can I do? How can I be involved and make this more of a community as opposed to an other?
First of all, thank you for letting us know that there are talkbacks after every performance, because we can't always get there for the Sunday night talkback. So we'll get our tickets. A perennial religious and human theme is that of the scapegoat. And, you know, you talked about marginalization. Your characters have all been scapegoats and marginalized to some degree. You know, a woman. The current target is a Muslim man, Jewish man, both African-American and woman. And I'm wondering how, you know, do you see that in the play? And how does that affect your relationships?
I think
more understanding because, you know, historically you've each been the scapegoat. Also, does the play speak to the complexity of that issue? It seems to me that it's, you know, when we have difficult, complicated problems, we look for a simple solution, and scapegoating is easy. Mm-hmm.
It is.
I think that's such a great question.
That is, that's great, yeah.
I feel like it's a little hard, anyway, for me, about my character to be too specific without giving things away.
Yeah.
But I think that the general answer is that in the play, it sort of drives us further apart.
Yeah.
And people sort of, when they're threatened, often life, tend to step back into their tribe and attack from their tribe. And I think that that happens a little bit in this play.
Yeah.
The gender stuff is so interesting because it's not really an issue for Emily for most of the play. And then that's all I can really say. But, yeah, do you guys want to address?
I will agree completely with what Tori just said. I think the history behind each one of these characters actually drives us further apart in the play. It's part of the downfall. So tribalism is a huge part of the play, and you guys can draw your own conclusion as to whether, when you see it, as to whether tribalism in terms of this play is a good thing or a bad thing. But I don't think we give a whole lot away in saying that instead of sort of lifting us up, mm-hmm. it actually divides us mm-hmm. in the play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think part of it is that every one of the characters, the backgrounds, they have been part of the marginalized at one point.
And it's how quickly do we forget?
Right.
It's not my turn. It's your turn now. I can't remember what that was like. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, you can't be experiencing that. No, it's in your mind, you know? And that's the thing. It's the next one to go through it, it's a very alone experience, you know? And a lot of times the experience is negated by doubt, by Victoria's mentioned a few times, not listening. You know, there's a lot of talking, but there's not a lot of listening, you know? And I think that's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering, as you get more comfortable with your parts, does the way you play them change at all? Or are you basically the same when you started rehearsal as where you are right now?
It's a little different every night.
She freezes her performance. She doesn't change a thing.
She doesn't even look at us.
No.
It's one woman show. No,
it's
right.
You know, the little things that change. Yeah. There's a consistency that you hope to maintain. And then it's like jazz, you know, then you just add notes and it kind of deepens here and there and, you know, something might change a little bit, depending on the audience too also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. The difference between live theater and the movies.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
I've always likened my favorite part of running a show is the idea of I'm a tinkerer. Like if my part were a used car, I'm the guy who's out on the, you know, in the driveway with the hood up, messing around. I love like doing something different just for the sake of doing something different, but like jazz, you know, if the situation gives you something, it's like, ooh, where's that headed? You know, I mean. And it's a fine line, right? You want to also ensure trust with each other. You want to make sure that you're not, you know, just going off the rails. So it's the same way. I think jazz is a very apt metaphor because, you know, jazz musicians trust each other implicitly, but they can go where they need to go.
Yeah, and you're always searching for something new, you know what I mean?
Because you have to discover it fresh every time.
It's got
to
be new every time,
or they can tell. I mean, if you're doing it for muscle memory, it's bad.
Yeah.
It's really bad. So it has to be, you have to have that thought for the first time. So you always have an opportunity to investigate it more deeply. Explore it more fully.
Yeah.
Did I interrupt you?
No, you said.
I got excited.
You said what I was going to say.
And one more question, please.
Good morning. I am just so pulled into the play. Haven't seen it yet. I did in the past couple weeks see the movie Fences, which I saw a number of August Wilson plays. And one of the things that happens to me is when I see it, and it's done, I sit there and think to myself, I need a therapy session. This is just like overwhelming. And my point is that I think I'll speak for myself, when I see something very powerful on the stage, I sometimes get caught up in the processing of what happened, how this applies, what I should do, what I should say. Mm. So I'm just curious if for the four actors and director, is there a question that you could pose to the audience that might either help us plow through our processing of what's happening or something that you may help us if we get caught up in the forest and we're not seeing any of the trees. Such the same way that the man in the audience got up and said, what can I do to help you? Is there some way that you can help us either process this material or take some action if we found ourselves just caught up in processing all this material so quickly? Because there's politically a lot going on right now, and there's change, and there's a lot of unknowns. And for many of us, this is a very scary time. So what to do, any thoughts you may have about questions you would like to pose the audience to help us move forward with this material?
I just want to give you a hug right now because I think we all sort of have felt that way as we were doing the play. Unfortunately, my answer to you is the play is the answer to that question. That's the playwright wrote it in that way so that you would exactly do that, get caught in the processing of it.
Mm-hmm.
This play is a play that does not, I don't think it, again, gives much away, but the play doesn't really resolve. And it was written that way specifically so that people would walk out doing this. And it's very intentional. So I'm sorry that we're about to do that to you. And I'll give you a hug afterwards.
I mean, I don't think the processing is bad.
No.
I think that if you are sort of confronted with a lot of rawness, with a lot of tangible struggle, that it's fine to be in that place, because, you know, then that means that we still have some work to do, and that, you know, that, and it's the acknowledgement that we live in a complicated world. Yeah. And that it's okay to not feel good and be uneasy. And the thing is, we probably feel uneasy about things because things aren't right, or because we're emotionally sort of deficient or bankrupt in a way because of a certain situation. And, you know, there's no way to get through but to get through. So, you know, I think when you mentioned the August Wilson play, absolutely. I mean, I've seen that play, I've read it, but seeing it again, my experience as well was like, some of it was so raw and so real, I felt uncomfortable watching it. And you're going to feel uncomfortable watching this too. And, you know, it's okay, as long as the processing doesn't just stop at, I feel uncomfortable, I want to leave now. Because that's oftentimes what we do. You know, stay for the talkbacks, try to get the understanding, see how it's tangible and real in your life, and continue to take that into your community. But you're not gonna get that release.
It's true, there's no catharsis in this play either. I mean, there's no, you know, cleansing through
absolutely
tears.
Absolutely not, none of that.
You know, it doesn't give you time for that, it doesn't give you anything like that. It really is about the processing. It's a problem play
that
you grapple with, you know?
Yeah.
I think the question is, what's your role in the whole situation? What's my role? Are we willing to take responsibility for our actions, and are we willing to then take action? Because it's one thing to say, I believe such and such, but be quiet about it, you know. But if there's a problem, is someone willing to do something about it,
right,
and stand up for somebody else?
Mm-hmm. You know? And do something doesn't have to be monumental,
no,
monolithic. It can just be a small thing, whatever that is, you know. But I think that's probably one of the things that might help. That whatever you do doesn't have to be huge, but it should be personal. It should be you with another human being, or two, or five, you know?
Do you know that this is a sanctuary community?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you for your questions. In closing, I just want to mention that as part of the runs of our show, virtually all of our shows, we have student matinees, 10:30 student matinees for school kids. And for this show, we had, there were two, and there were high school students. So just in closing, if I can ask the cast just to say a brief word about something that stands out for you, for the talk back that you may have had with one of our school groups.
I mean, I was very impressed with the students. They asked a lot of insightful questions, not only about the play, but, you know, societally. And I was so impressed because they were brave, so brave, and I think more insightful than our adult audience, because they're still learning and they're still figuring it out. So they weren't coming from a place of like staunch belief. I believe this and I felt uncomfortable. What can I do? They're still trying to figure out how to be decent human beings. And I think one of the most beautiful questions got asked towards the end of the first student matinee. A young man said, what do you do and how do you reach out and, you know, become more productive if you still don't know who you are yet and what you believe? And I just thought that was so beautiful, because he wants to be a productive, inclusive person in society, and he's still trying to figure it out. And I told him that that's a beautiful place to start. You don't have to know all the answers. No one's 100% right. No one's 100% wrong. But being open and being in that place is beautiful, because you're open to people and experiences, and letting people and your interactions with people and your experience dictate your beliefs, instead of just believing in something because someone told you to prescribe to a box, or because you have this identity that you have to think this way. And I thought that was really, really beautiful. That's really, really stood out for me.
One of the students, I don't want to give away the ending, but he talked about the very ending of the play, and the way he described it,
actually changed my perception
of it.
Enlightened me.
Brilliant.
And I was like, that's what this play is about. Really, you know, so it was
I've done it twice, and now I know.
Yeah.
Great. I'm going to turn it over to Bob Hupp for a few closing remarks.
Well, as a producer at Syracuse Stage, I would be remiss if I didn't say that the wonderful thing about Disgraced is that it wrestles with the issues that we've discussed today, but it's not a grim slugfest of a play. It is an incredibly well-crafted play, and the reason it's the most produced play in America is not just because it raises the themes that we've discussed today and presents tough questions, but because it's so beautifully written, because it is funny. Even in the reading we did today, you can see that there's humor in the play. The playwright has done such a good job in this 90-minute play of crafting such a complex and interesting situation and given us such three-dimensional characters that's what brings the play to life. When you put that kind of playwriting with these kind of actors, you get an amazing experience that only live theater can deliver. And so that's where the power of the play lies. And so as we wrestle with these very important societal issues, we also have to acknowledge the art of the playwright and the art of the craftsmanship and the artistry of these performers. And so I encourage you to come down and see our production of Disgraced this weekend and next weekend and experience it for yourself. And I want to thank all of you for joining us today, and we want to thank you for inviting us today. I want to thank Kyle for his expertise here today, and I particularly want to thank our actors who got up very early to come and visit with you today. So thank you all very much.